Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast. I'm Maurice O'Keefe. This week's podcast is somewhat different to what you have been listening to. It's coming to you from a very remote part of the world, the Falkland Islands. In 2009, I was commissioned to go there and to carry out research on the few people left living on the islands who could remember life as it was before the conflict in 1982. So my first destination was to go and meet Sir Cosmo Haskard. He was the governor of the Falkland Islands between 1964 and 1970. And in this clip, he describes the unrest between the Argentinians and the Falkland Islanders.
It was really after I got back to the Falklands that I began to be really seriously concerned. And I was concerned by the fact that the British government seemed to be slipping into a position of it being inevitable that they would not take any action to look after the Falklands.
Mm-hmm. So what did you do?
Well, that's when I then eventually, mm-hmm. I thought, well, all these letters and telegrams are having no effect, and I asked if I could go back, which I did. And it so happened, that, again, luck, I've been so lucky in all these things, a very nice chap called Summerhayes, who was the number two in the British Embassy in Buenos Aires in Argentina, had come down to the Falklands to assess the position, and he stayed with us. And he spent about a week or 10 days, I suppose. And I took passage in HMS Protector from the Falklands up to Montevideo en route to England. I flew from Montevideo to London. And Summerhayes was a fellow passenger. And Summerhayes made a report to his boss, who was the British ambassador in Buenos Aires, Sir Michael Creswell. And at that stage, I hadn't seen I knew what mm-hmm. Summerhayes was likely to say, because we discussed it so much, but he actually used some phrase in his report that he thought the positions between the Great Britain and Argentina over the Falklands were really unbridgeable. That may not have been the actual word he used, but something like that.
After I arrived in Stanley, I got acquainted with the archives there and met Jane Cameron. She also gave me an old army jeep to make my way around the rough tracks on the mainland and also access to flights to go from one island to the other. So my first destination was to fly to Port Stephens. It's one of the most westerly parts of the Falkland Islands. And there I met the Robinsons and spoke to Anne and Peter, and first asked Peter how long the Robinsons were farming in Port Stephens.
Fifth generation. Scotland via New Zealand. My grandfather came to the islands in 1896 to the agricultural department, where he spent 13 years ran the agriculture department. And then in 1909, the manager here, Henner, was killed here in Stevens, so with a horse. And my grandfather came out here as manager, and he was here as managing until about 1936. And then my father took over.
Anne pointed out here how concerned she was about receiving provisions to Port Stevens. It used to come by ferry, and now it's all changed.
We are at this end of the islands finding it very difficult because where before everything got delivered to our doorstep, now we have to go and fetch it. And since the ferry started, it's even further away than it used to be. So we are struggling now.
Yeah. Can I take you back again? Sorry, Peter. Can I take you back again to a time, I suppose, when you came over and you made all these changes? You brought in the motorbike. You brought in the idea of women working on the land as well. What other changes did you make?
Oh, there's quite a few of them, which I noticed. They were frowned on at the time, but I notice most people do it now. Like even land marking, traditionally it was done the 14th of November. Everyone on the 14th of November farms, they all went away land marking. I left it until January, and I got into hot water from all sorts of people, but I still did it anyway. The lambs can be all around the sheep at the end of the day. Yeah. The ewes can be, and all the lambs, they're all mixed up. But the ewe won't be interested in them. She'll go back and look where she lost the lamb. And the lamb's probably there, right beside her. But she's not interested. She's straight, as soon as you let them go, they're straight back to look where they lost the lamb.
When I returned to Stanley, I met the McKay family and I spoke to Claire and Bill. Claire had a very interesting occupation in going around the Falklands on horseback. First, as a helper with the teacher, but then turning out to be a teacher herself. Bill, who got no education, they both talked to me here about their experiences.
Oh, where did your people, Claire, come? What's your maiden name?
It was Morrison.
Morrison?
Mm-hmm.
Where did the Morrisons come?
Well, my father came from the little island of Scalpe when he was 19. Donkey's years ago. 103, I think it was. But my mother was a born Falkland Islander, the same as Bill's mother.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. But the generation before that, both came from Scotland.
Yes, the men folk did.
Yeah.
But the women folk were all from here. Well, my great-grandmother was from Ireland. Oh, yes, she's Ireland. Because I don't care for greens, and my granny had everything green in the house, shamrocks and all. Everything had to be green because she was great on the Irish.
Whereabouts in Ireland?
I don't know where she came. You'll have to talk to our daughter, Rena. She's doing the family tree, so she knows where they all came from. But I haven't a clue where they came from in Ireland.
But it'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah. I'll ask her, Rena. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And
so there's a bit of Irish blood in you, so.
I just, oh yes, that's right, yes, bit of Scotch and Irish, I think.
It's a good mixture, isn't it?
Oh well, hopefully. It's lasted a long time anyway.
For your early days, Bill, did you get much schooling?
No. No, I didn't. And because, I don't know, this, the old managers, they didn't like you to be educated. Because you wouldn't stay on the farm. If you was educated, you'd be off and away on a boat or something. This is the tale I've always been told.
So I travelled round on my horse with the teacher from one farm to another. And they used to do a month in each settlement and 2 weeks in each outside house, each shepherd's house, with the children. So I'd be 6 months away from my home. Without ever seeing parents. I started at 9 years old and until I was 16, travelling with the teacher. You couldn't get education otherwise, and then I went to travel and teacher myself, and travelled from farm to farm.
But when you were terribly young, and you were going around with the teacher, were there other children going with you?
Some of them, yes, there were some of them.
Oh, and you'd all travel off?
Yes, some of them. Yeah. We all had to go on a horse. And if the teacher stayed, like, at my parents' house, then my father had to see him to his next port of call, as it were.
Yeah.
But if he stayed at another house, then that dad had to take him to his next place.
And he'd show him how to get to the next place?
Well, then. Yes. There was, there were some children didn't go every time, and some went every time. And
My next destination was to fly to Sanders Island. It's a remote island off the west side of the Falkland Islands. And there I met Tony Paul Evans, a remarkable man with an incredible story.
What numbers in sheep? Was there a big lot?
7,000 when I came here. We did go up a bit more, up to 80,000 a while ago there, but we had to cut back again, down to 7,000 mark again now.
And the workforce to manage that, how many people were here?
Oh, I usually had about 5 or 6 people working for me.
And did they come with their families, or were they on their own?
Yeah, most of them had families. I had one single fellow who used to come here. And one family lived up here, another one, or two families used to live up in this house, and one down in the stone house.
And they were, they'd stay with you for a long time, did they? Or?
Oh, no, they didn't stay long. They shipped it around.
Different families came and left. And and that was in the 40s, was it 50s? Yeah. And to come out here, I mean, I came out in a plane, but how would people, by boat?
Yeah.
And the... So, for a long time, you wouldn't see anybody other than the people living here.
No, not see them, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's all the time people used to come on. The first couple of years there, I didn't have a motorboat. You had to row across the other point and pick them up there. And had a motorboat after that. I guess quite a few people come to see us.
Right. And of course, the main interest really was in wool. So shearing was a big part of all of that, wasn't it?
That's why we kept so many people.
Yeah.
To do the shearing. No contract shearers in them days.
Mm.
When I came here, there was no running water, no electricity.
How did you manage? I mean... Where was the well on the island?
Well, that was a problem. That would run out, and then you used to have to go way over the hill here, or way over that way there, about a quarter mile, and carry water in buckets.
My.
The arms got a bit tired by the time you got back to the house.
And how many acres did you plough, do you mind me asking?
Hmm?
How many acres did you plough?
Oh, I don't know. I never measured them.
Well, quite a distance.
Might have been about a mile long, about a quarter of a mile wide, something like that.
Did you? My goodness, yeah.
So I was there doing it for 6 weeks.
Where are you?
Swim the horses onto the island there. And they had the tussock border on. You used to put them in the tussock overnight there. And
yeah.
Get them in, put the harness on, into the plough, and away you go.
What was the name of the island again?
River Island.
But it's
way down here to the west, east of us.
And you, how far did you have to swim the horses about?
We were about a mile across there. Port Purvis across the River Island, about a mile where you swim them.
Did you do all this work on your own?
Hmm?
Did you do it on your own?
No, I had a mate.
The two of you headed off.
Yeah.
When I left Tony Paul Evans and Sanders Island, I travelled back to the mainland and to a place called Hill Cove, where I met Tony and Dean Anderson.
And looking out your window here, you're right into the, you're on the edge of the sea, right on the edge of the cliff, really.
Yeah.
So would that weather have played a big part in your lives, you know, the sea gales, the weather?
It did today. It always does, whichever way the wind is. Mm. You know, the only good thing about this house is always one end that's really warm. If it's blowing a gale and freezing from that end, we're always warm up here. But this morning and last night, this kitchen was freezing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I asked Rye, when did the Andersons first come to the Falkland Islands?
As far as I know, my grandfather jumped ship. He was a Dane, I think.
He was. Chico pulls our leg and says that they chucked him off the ship. And his name was Charlie, wasn't it? Charlie Hanson.
Yeah.
We spent a long time here in Hill Cove.
September 54 and come here in a month later.
Yeah.
So living here for that length of time, it's very permanent then, you know.
That's what happened around here. You see, most of the people that were here have been here all their lives. Hill Cove was just a good place to work. And
so working for a big estate, because it was, how many acres?
144,000, I think, somewhere like that. And we used to run 33,000 sheep.
Mm.
And when we came here, Bill Blake was manager, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Mr. Harding had retired by then.
So this was quite a big settlement here in Hill Cove.
How many? 30, 40 people?
Yeah, it must have been. We used to have 12 or 14 single lads in the cookhouse.
The telephone system again, you were just showing me outside.
Yes.
Can you explain to me how it worked?
Well, every house had a ring, a separate ring. Now, our house would be, what was our ring? Two shorts and a long.
Yeah.
Main Point had five long rings. Charabay had four long rings. And in the Tim and Sally's house was a long and a short. And because a lot of the rings were the same, that's why you had your switchboards. Because if someone rang me to say, put me through to Fox Bay, I would then put the switch over to the main line and ring my Aunt Lottie, who lived at Goring House, who would then fill with her switches and ring Fox Bay, then connect it up and put it through. And then I'd put the switch back and tell people they were connected through.
Is there anything you would change if you had your life all over again?
No, I don't think so. No.
Would you live the same kind of life again?
Yes, I would, yeah. Because I'm glad I had all these different things happening, because horse riding's gone for good now, more or less, that way of life and the way we used to be. And then after that came the motorbikes came next, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then the rovers, and it's all changed. The only thing I would like to see, less vehicles around, they're so messy.
I left Hill Cove and the Hansons and returned again to Stanley, and there I met, to my surprise, somebody who had Kerry connections.
Riley Short, it's lovely to sit down here in your house and talk to you. Riley is actually a surname. Can you explain that?
Yes, well, that why I'm called Riley is because one of my great-grandsons, who came from Ireland, was William Riley.
What part?
Kerry. I think it must have been from Kerry, because that's, as far as I know, from my mother's. Yeah. That was on my mother's side. And he was a Marine that came here. I think they came here in about 1850 or something like that. And he married... He was married to a Danish woman, so I'm half part Irish and part Danish. You know, as it comes down to it, that on my mother's side. And I'm not sure whether he went back to Ireland or not, because there doesn't seem to be any more of the family around apart from my grandmother and one or two of her brothers. So he may have died here, or he may have went back to Ireland. I'm not sure about that.
And Rye goes on to talk about what he did for many years of his life.
I really started off as a sealer on the ships. When I was a boy, I joined the sealing company. We were killing seals, and that was in 1950-51. And I really started off on that.
And
that was at Albemarle, a place called Albemarle, and we were used to go around the islands and gather up all the seal and shoot them and take them off onto another boat, a sealing boat, and take it to the sealing station where they take them ashore and render them down for oil.
Where was the station?
Albemarle.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Albemarle.
And that kind of work, what exactly were you doing?
I was ashore. I was ashore on the. I was on the ship, so I went killing the seal and gutting them and whatever you have to do on to take the seals back off to the boat, but you choose to take the guts out of them and just put them onto a big long rope, which we call the yawl, and then floated them off to the ship.
I'm just imagining the stench and
that was hard work. Was hard work.
My next destination was to go to Goose Green to meet the Lee family, and there I met John Lee, and he spoke to me about being on the island ship that serviced the islands. Now, that was the same ship that was built in Baltimore, in Ireland, and sailed down there in 1929 and serviced the islands for over 70 years. And it had recently been brought back and rebuilt again and remains now here in Ireland.
It's lovely being out here in Goose Green and talking to the Lee family, talking to John and Elizabeth. And I must say, to come out here on a summer's day with snow falling, it's a bit different, isn't it? But so, John, can you tell me how long you've been here? Have you been here always in Goose Green?
No. I've been well around. I've travelled a bit. I've been on the sea for a few years. On the island, you know her?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Were you?
I travelled a few miles on her. She used to be the cutter at Speedwell.
So from day one you loved the sea?
Yeah.
And when you were on the boat, what were you doing? I mean,
going from island to island. We had a lot of islands to look after. We used to go around all them.
Did you? Yeah.
Shearing and pressing and whatnot, dipping.
Who was skipper on that boat when you were a young lad?
Sandy Bonner.
And how many other lads working on that boat?
Three or four.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you find that tough work or hard work?
It was hard work.
I bet you, yeah.
It sure was.
My final destination was to meet Winnie Loxton. She lived in Stanley and spoke here about the communications with the islanders and the responsibility her husband had as the postmaster.
The boat that delivered that serviced the islands, that was another extension, wasn't it?
Yes, that's right. I suppose the mail to the west was very restricted until we got the plane, and then it was dropped, wasn't it? Of course, people, if they were riding in from the camp, East Falklands, they would take people's mail as they knew they had to pass by, so that...
Oh, yes, one would help out
yes,
the other.
Yes, oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes. It, really, I know in many ways we didn't have lots of things that people expect these days, but I do think perhaps we were a great deal happier.
Mm.
Everybody looking after one another instead of just yourself, as it does tend to be in the world of today. I'm all right, Jack.
Having the I'm just thinking Henry's job as postmaster, and responsibilities of making sure that all the letters would get there. It must have been full time, very difficult. Was there pressure in that job, do you think?
Well, yes. And as after we started the philatelic, he used to work lots of evenings.
The radio meant a lot to people out in camp.
Oh, yes. Well, it did to us as well, because the evenings were... You looked forward to it coming on, because it wasn't on all day and all night like it is now. Mm. It was gave you... You were very keen to get it and you know, listen properly and get all the news, and there would be music evenings and serials and first science fiction things came on there. We used to all, and the Archers, which we don't get now.
You've been listening to the voices of the Falkland Island people living in remote islands on the Falklands. And this project had been carried out in 2009. And it reminded me a little bit of Ireland in the 1950s and 60s. It was indeed a unique project, something I will never forget. I'm Maurice O'Keefe, and I look forward to bringing you another podcast next week.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.